From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America presents Issues in the News. The nation's top Washington correspondents offer their perspectives on the week's major stories. Your moderator is Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Issues in the News begins now.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard, and joining me on the show this week are David Rennie, the Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist, and Tim Mack, Senior Congressional Correspondent for The Daily Beast. And here are the issues. An Air Asia airliner with 162 passengers aboard crashed in Southeast Asia, the second mysterious airline accident in the region in 2014. In Moscow, Alexei Navalny, a prominent critic of President Vladimir Putin's government, was convicted of fraud. He was not sentenced to imprisonment, though, but his brother was given a 3.5-year prison term. Along with these events, we'll look ahead to issues developing in the new year, including negotiations over Iran's nuclear program, the effect of the dramatic drop in global oil prices, America's relationship with Cuba and North Korea, and the new political situation in Washington as President Obama faces an all-Republican Congress. Well, let's start with this Air Asia airliner. Once again, we know very little about what happened to it and what might have caused this crash into the ocean. And there's been a lot of talk. There's been a lot of talk after the earlier accident, Flight 370, about there ought to be some sort of technology required of the airline so we will know what happened and where the flight might have crashed. David?
Yeah, that seems to be the kind of the only sort of practical and rational thing to say about this. I think there's a lot of nonsense being talked about. Why is it always these Malaysian planes?
Oh, yeah.
And where are they go? And all these conspiracy theories. The truth is, if you actually look at the statistics, this has been an unusually safe year overall for an industry that's already staggeringly safe. I mean, these crashes are incredibly rare. 100,000 planes take off and land every day around the world. You know, these crashes are incredibly rare. That said, given the incredible technology, given that, you know, when you take an airliner on some carriers now, you can get internet while you're in the air, and given that when we walk around the streets, our mobile phones track us constantly, it cannot be beyond the wit of man to have these planes pinging back a signal every few minutes, actually saying where they are. I mean, they can do that with UPS trucks, they can do it with airliners. So there seems to be some resistance, presumably on grounds of cost from the airlines, but, you know, we may see some movement towards a change.
Tim, what do you make of this crash? I mean, here we have had these two mysterious airline accidents in one region, and we still know practically nothing about the earlier one and very little about this one.
And let's not forget the third one, which was
the plane shot down
over Ukraine by rebels aided by Russia. It's yet another tragic disaster here that's befallen Indonesian people. But I think David makes the most important point, which is let's not panic here. Traveling by plane is still incredibly safe, especially as compared to, say, traveling by automobile, where we have millions of people perishing every year. This is something that probably needs some incremental safety regulations updates or something like that. But even that's up for debate. Right now, it's really about the human side of this, which is the tragedy.
It certainly is a tragedy, and it would be good to know what has actually gone on with these airliners, but it probably is a cost problem at the moment. Well, let's turn to Russia. Has Alex Navalny's brother been taken as a hostage? Because the Putin government was, I think, a little hesitant to throw their chief critic, a dissident, Alexei Navalny, in jail.
You know, commentators have spent the last few years writing kind of sort of allegorical pieces about how this feels more and more like Tsarist Russia, this feels more and more like a kind of Dostoevsky novel. And actually, those allegories now look just like a kind of fairly bland description of reality. You offend the Tsar, Vladimir Putin, and, you know, if it doesn't suit him politically to punish you by throwing you in jail on trumped-up charges, well, you know, the trumped-up charges just get a little bit of rewriting, and voila, your brother's in prison for 3 years, even though he has no connection with the trumped-up charges.
Exactly.
I mean, it's an incredibly kind of czarist model. What is interesting is, why does anyone still frighten Vladimir Putin? I mean, that's an interesting question. If Vladimir Putin was completely and utterly 100% in charge, why would he need to do this?
And he's enormously popular, right?
He's enormously popular. So the single biggest reason, you have to conclude, is that this critic of Vladimir Putin's, Alexei Navalny, whose brother has been jailed, when he ran for mayor of Moscow, even though state TV and the state propaganda machine basically didn't talk about him at all or only in negative ways, he landed more than a quarter of the vote against the handpicked candidate of Vladimir Putin. Now, that's in Moscow. Moscow is the most sophisticated, or one of the most sophisticated cities, with St. Petersburg. In the provinces, in the countryside, Vladimir Putin is still pretty popular. But you have a man who's looking more nervous than a czar should.
He does look nervous. This seems entirely unnecessary, don't you think, Tim? Or what is he up to? Putin, I'm talking of.
The big question over the year 2014 is whether Putin is acting from a position of strength or a position of weakness, whether the invasion of Crimea and the aid to rebels in eastern Ukraine was because Russia was powerful or because Russia was weak and could not achieve its means by any other way. Navalny certainly seems to think that he's being personally punished. I mean, he made an outburst in the courtroom railing against the government, saying it needed to come down, saying that his brother was being punished for his opposition to the government. I think, again, David makes a great point. This is essentially a bit of insecurity from a man who otherwise has very powerful grip on this society.
Well, Tim makes a brilliant point. In 2014, you know, you asked the question about was he operating from strength or weakness when he invaded and basically grabbed successfully Crimea and has now created a kind of frozen conflict in eastern Ukraine, which suits his geopolitical interests. But let's look at 2015. How weak or strong does he look there? Because the big, big news for Russia right now is the collapsing global oil price, which I know we're going to turn to later, but Russia had a chance a few years ago to try and diversify its economy, to try and move away to a more modern economy which actually added value, that didn't just ship raw petrochemicals out of the country and hydrocarbons out of the country, but it was just too easy and too lucrative and allowed for so much centralized control to carry on doing it the old Soviet way, but with a kind of dose of personal corruption added, that Putin has basically continued to turn his country into a kind of corrupt petrostate. Mm-hmm. And now the oil price has collapsed way below the point that the Russian budget assumed it would. You know, let's not forget, only a few months ago, it was above $100 a barrel. The Russian budget was predicated on about $75 a barrel. That's when the numbers sort of still added up. We're now down to 60, more or less, take some change, a barrel, even below, and heading possibly down to the kind of the high 50s. So at that point, Russia's bust. And not only is Russia bust, but those sanctions that America and its allies put on after the Ukraine invasion, which at the time looked a little bit too kind of narrow and specific and all to do with things like bank
weak.
No, they looked very, very narrow. They would look very narrow, but actually they're having a remarkable effect, because what they really affect is the ability of these big state-owned companies in Russia to roll over their very large debt. And because Western banks do not want to be on the wrong side of the U.S. Treasury, they're just not extending new loans to these big companies. So actually, there's a kind of perfect storm, to use the great cliche, brewing around the Russian economy.
We're going to go ahead, since David has pushed the oil price issue on us, and thank you, David. I guess you get around to the question is, what happens to Russia now and what happens to Putin? Because it doesn't look like oil prices are going to be rising dramatically anytime in the near future.
Right. Well, it's a question for Putin. It's also a question for Venezuela. It's a question for many dictatorships around the world that rely on oil prices as a means for sustaining public funds. Dictatorships aside, I mean, the Scottish referendum decision this year is looking more interesting in the wake of falling oil prices. Had they voted for independence and they were depending on oil revenues as a major portion of their budget, it's starting to look like a better decision that they didn't leave.
Indeed. Well, what about, Tim has raised the questions of Venezuela, I mentioned Iran. Mm-hmm. You have these group of countries, all non-democracies. What happens in 2015 as a result of this? We've talked about Russia, but what about the others?
It's incredible, the kind of cascading geopolitical effects. I mean, let's back up one little bit. Why is the price of oil falling as fast as it has? Well, one thing that is going on is the Saudis, who have not only the world's largest oil reserves, but crucially, the cheapest to get out of the ground. Mm-hmm. They have the largest tap to be turned on and off anywhere in this kind of vast global market. And normally, if they were concerned about their revenues, and that was the only thing that worried them, as the oil price fell, which hurts their revenues, they would have slowed supply. The less oil on the market, the price would have gone up. They've not done that. They're continuing to pump as much as ever. And there was a mystery for a few weeks as to why the Saudis were doing it. Was it geopolitical? Were they trying to hit the Iranians, whatever? We've now heard from the Saudis that what they're trying to do is to preserve market share. They believe that they're basically prepared to take the pain of less money coming in and lower revenues to preserve their market share. And this is a fight, among others, with the Americans and the shale oil. Because the Saudis are prepared to take the pain, they're prepared to see the price go even lower to preserve market share. This is having extraordinary effects on Venezuela, Tim mentioned. One reason why the Cubans were prepared to do a deal was because they are utterly dependent on Venezuela for cheap oil. And without cheap Venezuelan oil, Cuba falls over. So you can see these cascading effects. The problem is, and a lot of them hurting people that we don't much care for. So mm-hmm. you could feel quite cheerful about that.
Well, don't the Saudis have, at least in the back of their mind, this is going to hurt our Middle Eastern foe, the Iranians?
Absolutely. But it seems, if you believe the Saudis, if you take them at face value, that's a happy side effect of their fight to preserve their market share and their dominant position as the kind of supplier with the veto power over the price.
It hurts some friends as well. Let's not forget the Canadian oil sands, which are very expensive to actually take oil out of.
Right.
It's not cost effective below $60 a barrel. Mm-hmm. And so what you're going to see is America's neighbors to the north really struggling when it comes to public funds, especially in the West, because of the falling price of oil.
And a fascinating political thing there, suddenly the pressure to build the Keystone Pipeline, a very domestic American story, this oil pipeline to carry tar sands from Canada, it's getting less and less relevant.
But it's become such a, at least in the abstract, an important issue now that they're fighting on. It's the first thing that Mitch McConnell, the new majority leader in the Senate, says he's going to raise. I talked to him a couple of days ago, and he still plans to raise it and be voted on just in the next few days.
And they'll do it, and they'll claim it's going to create millions of jobs, and that's hooey, and environmentalists will say it's the one thing that's going to destroy the world, and that's hooey too. So it's just a pipe.
But what about the pipeline, the Keystone Pipeline, while we're discussing oil, Tim? It is a huge issue, regardless of its impact.
Yeah, it's become a huge issue. It's kind of a touchstone for environmentalists and for conservatives who are saying we need to develop energy domestically. It's really a minor issue. From a permanent perspective, it would create only a few dozen jobs. What it's going to do is going to transport oil, not take it out of the ground. And the Keystone XL pipeline will simply replace more dangerous methods of transporting oil that would have put the environment more at risk, like by train, if you were to transport oil by train. So that's really interesting. From a political perspective, it's something that Republicans have been hammering the president on for a very long time. And you can expect, as you were saying, them to make it a real priority in the new year.
Well, they've announced that, and it's an issue in which they pick up a few Democratic votes. It's not,
bipartisan. But it's political kabuki theater, because the idea is that Democrats hate energy and don't drill and don't. Yeah. But actually, President Obama has presided over a very happy energy industry that's drilling, you know, pretty much.
I know, but no thanks to him. The next step, if he really wanted to develop more oil, would be to allow federal lands to be used for oil exploration.
I don't look around and see energy companies with a lack of places to drill right now. They're very happy. Their profits are kind of doing pretty nice.
They're not complaining about profits, that's for sure. Anyway, we're going to have more in just a minute. First, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me today are David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief, Lexington columnist for The Economist, and the man who seems to be setting the issues here instead of me.
I'm sorry.
Bringing up oil prices. And Tim Mack, Senior Congressional Correspondent for The Daily Beast. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. The program is also available for a free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/issuesinthenews. Well, let's turn to, I think, the issue that will be particularly big in 2015 are the negotiations over the Iranian nuclear program. Obviously, President Obama wants a deal. You wonder whether he wants one too much or whether the Iranians now are in trouble now because of oil prices. They may need a deal more than they did before for one reason or another. Anyway, what about it, David?
Well, you have this weird sort of deadlock where it's pretty clear that nobody has any appetite to kind of war with Iran. So if the idea is that the way to stop Iran is to have a war with Iran, to bomb Iran so they don't get a bomb, you know, there isn't a war camp in Congress demanding war.
Or anywhere else, for that
matter. Certainly not among Western allies. So President Obama, in one way, has quite a good hand to play, that everyone agrees with him that talks backed by sanctions is the only rational response to this Iranian problem. Nobody can guarantee that that will work, because there is plenty of evidence from history that countries that really, really want a nuclear bomb can have one eventually. I mean, that's, you know, they will take any amount of pain to get one. And there are advantages to having a nuclear bomb. I mean, if you're a Nazi dictatorship, having a nuclear bomb keeps you safe. You know, you can see that.
North Korea.
Look at, you know, Muammar Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein end up dead in ditches because, you know, or hanged because they didn't have a bomb. But the problem that President Obama faces clearly over the next year, now that Republicans have total control of Congress, particularly in the Senate with its power over foreign policy in various ways, the Senate is full of people who just don't trust him to do a good deal. They think that he's willing to do a bad deal to get a deal done. They think that he's weak. They think he's naive. They think he's feckless. They think he doesn't really believe in American exceptionalism. For all of those reasons, they think that he's capable of doing a terrible deal. And so they're keen to try and be a backstop, kind of to play good cop, bad cop, where if he's going to be too soft, they're going to try and put extra sanctions on, and he's then going to have to threaten to veto them. If you're an optimist, that good cop, bad cop thing might work quite well, because Obama can point to Congress and say, look, I can't give the Iranians too much because Congress won't let me. If you're going to be a pessimist, the Iranians have their own good cop, bad cop situation, where they have the hardliners and then the even harder liners.
Right.
And the even harder liners, it would be very easy for them to take advantage of stuff that Congress is saying and doing to walk away from the deal. So that's the kind of good cop, bad cop on both sides.
Well, the second extension of the talks expires sometime in the middle of the year,
June 30th.
Would they do another extension? Nobody seems to want to stop the talks either.
Well, what we see in Congress is that they certainly want to impose new sanctions. I mean, you've got a lot of support either for imposing sanctions preemptively or for this Kirk-Menendez sanction, these sanctions proposed by Senators Kirk and Senator Menendez.
Who's a Democrat. One Republican, one Democrat, yeah.
Basically imposing pretty deep sanctions if the Iranians were to renege on any portion of the deal thus far. And I think that the suspicion from a lot of Republicans and backed up by some statements from within the administration is not merely that the president is weak or feckless, but that he's desperate for a deal because he views the deal as the first step in a larger view of normalizing relations with Iran as sort of one of the legacy issues of his last 2 years in office, that this deal would be the first step in terms of creating better relationships with this country and allowing the United States and Iran to cooperate on regional issues of mutual interest.
Well, what do they do? Are they going to get a deal?
The problem is that the only person who really knows is the supreme leader in Iran. And it is possible that he doesn't even have to make a final decision. There's an Iranian analyst here in Washington who talks about, you know, they're driving their car down the road to Nuclearville, and we would like them to kind of just say they're never going to go there.
Yeah.
But actually, the Supreme Leader could just kind of park the car for a bit
and
just wait us out. Mm-hmm. So what we're really looking at is to go back to some Cold War vocabulary. We're looking at containment. Actually, is the best deal that we can get right now containment of an Iran that, you know, we'll have more breakout capacity, be closer to that kind of end line than we would like.
And perhaps tougher sanctions against them.
And tougher sanctions. But as Tim says, you know, we have plenty of reasons to want to work with the Iranians. I mean, if you look at the most severe burning acute threat to security in that region is extreme Sunni Islam in the form of the Islamic State and its allies. And that certainly threatens Iran and its proxies, Iran and its allies in Iraq. All of those reasons, America and Iran should be able to work together, but clearly not a nuclear armed
Iran. Tim, I forgot to ask you one thing about the pipeline. You come from Canada. What about Canadian-American relations? I mean, Stephen Harper, the prime minister, has made a huge issue over this. He's been trying to get Obama to approve the Keystone Pipeline since his first visit to Washington and the president in 2009.
Now, Canada has played a really interesting role this year in American foreign policy. You've got the Keystone XL pipeline, which, as you mentioned, Stephen Harper is really upset about. When the United States and Cuba have made their first tentative steps towards normalizing relations, where did the negotiations take place? Who hosted them? The Canadians. It's been interesting. I mean, the relationship between Canada and the U.S. has always been kind of underplayed because Canada is not as large of a player on the world stage. But Canada is the United States' largest trading partner. It's an economy that is interdependent with the United States and largely defends the United States pretty much everywhere on the world stage.
Here you can answer this yes or no, I guess. And that if the pipeline isn't built, isn't approved by the president, will that have any permanent damage to American-Canadian relations?
I think it will. I mean, because Canada is already pivoting towards Asia in a very real way. It's signing energy deals with China, for example. If the United States doesn't want Canada's oil, Canada will find a place for it.
Tim mentioned Cuba, David. What will be the impact of this recognition of the normalization of relations with Cuba, other than obviously there are going to be a lot of new resort hotels built in Cuba, and its economy will benefit at least
a little bit. It's a really hard one. So I've been to Cuba, you know, half a dozen times.
Really?
I've interviewed Cuban dissidents. You know, I have extraordinary sympathy for the Cuban dissidents who are currently saying that they are furious with President Obama for starting to sort of dismantle the embargo. And for, in their view, rewarding the dictators, the Castro brothers, for very little. I think the dissidents are wrong. I think the dissidents are fantastically brave and admirable people. I think they're wrong because they're misunderstanding what the embargo was. The embargo is a package of sanctions. Mm-hmm. Sanctions are not a moral punishment. Sanctions are a tool for getting stuff that you want. And we've tried them for 50 years. They clearly haven't worked. And in fact, worse than that, the Castros have got away with defending their unbelievably incompetent economic policies, which have driven a perfectly healthy country into the dust, by saying, well, of course we have a bad economy. There's the embargo.
No, but they had every other country in the world
dealing with them economically. So lift the embargo and expose them for what they are, which is utterly incompetent dictators.
Okay, I certainly agree with that. You know, we haven't gotten to an issue of President Obama in Washington with the Republicans. And, you know, both the Republicans and President Obama say, oh, yes, we want to get together and make and negotiate and make deals and compromises and be bipartisan and so on. Tim, you cover Congress. You know, that when the president and Mitch McConnell, the new majority leader, met, they only discussed three issues. Trade was one.
Mm-hmm. Tax reform.
Tax reform was one, and the other was building infrastructure and so on. And McConnell says he couldn't think of any other issues that they agree on. So what are the prospects on Obama-congressional relations?
I think you'll see probably movement on tax reform, mm-hmm. and you'll see maybe some trade,
yeah.
maybe some infrastructure spending, and that's pretty much what we can expect in terms of substantive accomplishments over the next 2 years. You'll see a lot of grandstanding. You'll see a lot of anger. You'll see a lot of heated debates. But absent foreign policy developments, it's not going to be the most productive Congress. Mm-hmm. And we look at what happened this year. Actually, since 2010, we have had two of the least productive Congresses of all time when measured in bills passed and signed by the president. That's not going to get more productive with a Republican-controlled Senate.
You know, David, I agree with Tim. But on the other hand, I think it would benefit both sides, the Republicans in Congress and the Democratic president, if they did move ahead on other issues than the three we've mentioned.
You know, the problem we're in, I think, is so we're in the centenary at the moment of the First World War. I'm predicting, as a professional columnist to another professional columnist, we're going to see a lot of World War One metaphors over the next few years. Trenches, people digging in, barbed wire, stalemate. And I wrote a column the other day, as it happens, about the World War One analogy, mm-hmm. which said the problem is we're at the early stage. We're kind of 1914, mm-hmm. where both sides hadn't worked out that they had constructed this perfect stalemate. Mm-hmm. And they were both sides were still dreaming of victory.
We didn't raise this issue, and yet it's been a big one at the end of the year, and that's North Korea. Mm-hmm. And I'm still not clear, David, maybe you are, but I'm not clear whether it was the North Koreans who actually hacked Sony.
It's looking less and less clear.
Yeah.
And in fact, I think The Economist has a piece this week saying that it's looking less and less clear that it was North Korea. The problem with North Korea is it's unbelievably hard in foreign policy to deal with a regime which sets absolutely no store whatsoever by the welfare of its own people. And that's what North Korea is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at no point do the North Koreans factor into their negotiations with the outside world the fact that their people are starving to death and live in a miserable country. I've been to North Korea a couple of times. Mm-hmm. It is totally different from every other country on Earth. You know, I've been to some nasty countries. Yeah. North Korea is by far the nastiest.
Well, that means sanctions won't work.
No, nothing works.
Yeah. Tim, what do you do when nothing works?
Not much hope. One thing that the United States can and probably will be doing over the next year is stepping up a little pressure on China, which mm-hmm. is really the only actor that could change the North Korean regime's attitude and actions.
They rely on China for so much. Why haven't the Chinese done that already?
I think because they realize that it's in their interest to keep the North Korean regime stable. They don't want refugees flooding over the Chinese border should the regime collapse.
Well, that's just such hooey. It's the Chinese line. Oh, there's like 20 million people in North Korea. That's like one city in China. You know, it's like an extra city.
Yes, but
it would be places for 20 million people.
Millions of people suddenly rushing.
The Chinese, just like the North Koreans don't care about the welfare of the North Korean people, guess what? The Chinese don't either. So they're the hostages in a buffer zone.
Well, do they like the North Koreans tweaking America's nose?
No. And Chinese officials will very rarely criticize other disgusting dictatorships.
Mm-hmm.
But the North Koreans is the one time that they'll say in private, they despise the North Koreans. They find the North Koreans abhorrent, their government. But it's a useful buffer zone, so there it stays.
Well, we have 1 minute to go. Let me ask you about this question. What have we not raised that you think may be a big issue in 2015, David?
Obviously, the British general election is going to dominate global headlines in 2015.
When is that?
That's in May 2015. But I think Europe is potentially about to fall off a cliff again. Mm-hmm. The European economies are incredibly sluggish. The Eurozone is not out of the woods.
Mm-hmm. I'm also interested to see what happens in West Africa, especially in the wake of the Ebola crisis, to see if it remains in the news in any significant way.
Well, it will, unless it's contained.
That's a good reminder. It's not over at all.
Yeah, not over at all. Okay. That's all the time we have. We covered 2 years, 2014 and 15. Joining us today were David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist, and Tim Mack, Senior Congressional Correspondent for The Daily Beast. This program was produced by Carol Castile. Our engineer was Bob Dowdy. I'm Fred Barnes of The Weekly Standard. Thanks for listening.
From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Issues in the News. You can email your questions or comments to our panelists. Send them to voanews@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune in the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us next week at this time for Issues in the News.